Brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Radio on time, on target. Very excited to have Benedetta Argentieri back here in studio. It's been quite a while, and this is the first time you're in the newer setup of the studio.
Yeah, it's very nice.
You were in the Chelsea setup.
I think this is
the
third time we've had you on the show.
Yeah.
I believe so. And we're having Benny on for good reason. New film out, directed by you, I Am the Revolution, which is going to premiere November 15th in New York City at Chelsea. 7:30, and you can check out tickets for that at docnyc.net. It's going to be at Sinopolis, Chelsea, Thursday, November 15th, 7:30 p.m. I'll be there. You'll be there. And, of course, you, the director, and the producers of the film as well, right?
So. Yeah, all the crew is going to be there. Oh, not all of it, all of them, but most of the crew, yeah. So the cinematographers who came with me to Syria and Afghanistan, they will be there. Second camera too, the producers, the editor, almost all crew.
So let's get into the background of the film itself. I mean, it follows three women in the Middle East and, you know, their struggle for equality, which is very much different than the struggle for equality here in America or Europe. It's a lot more drastic, of course, the laws against them, so...
Yeah, the idea was to challenge the media mainstream narrative about women in the Middle East. You often see them, you know, veiled, crying, maybe in like refugee camps with dozens of children around them, all dirty. And then traveling, you know, for the past 4 years, 4 or 5 years in the area, I noticed that that wasn't really the whole truth. I mean, this is part of reality, but there is also another side of the coin, which was like strong woman trying, you know, to fight back and struggle for gender equality in the region in the midst of war. So, you know, this is how we got to think about the film. And then, of course, the fun part is to go shoot and go on the ground. And there we followed three women, as you said, one in Syria, which is in Rojava, so the Kurdish area of Syria. And Rojda Felat is the main commander for the Raqqa operations. So she led 60,000 men and women to conquer the capital of the so-called Islamic State. And now she's finishing up the job in Syria where, you know, you have a little like tasks around the country in which ISIS is still there. Like one of the last one is Deir ez-Zor. And the second woman is an Iraqi woman. And she left Iraq in 1992. To escape the regime of Saddam Hussein. She moved to Canada and she finished the studies there. She did an MA in architecture. She started working, but it was something really off. And she kind of missed home and she wanted to do something with her country. So in 2002, while, you know, in America there were talks about invading Iraq, she started receiving calls from Baghdad saying that women were kidnapped on the streets and then sold to human traffickers or prostitution rings and so on. So she decided to, you know, write down the constitution of her organization and fled back on June 2003, a few months after the invasion. And so she started working over there and she set up, like, now she has like 10 underground shelter, underground because the Iraqi laws do not shield these shelters for women escaping violence, thinking that the woman should be always with a male relative. And so she's fighting also that part. And in the meantime, she receives women escaping violence, honor killing. Honor killing is that practice very still much on in Iraq, in which, you know, the male relatives have to protect the honor of the family. And if they caught the woman with a compromised situation, or even if they are violated, raped by whoever.
Or sometimes even just a rumor is enough.
Sometimes a rumor is enough, exactly. So they had to restore the honor. And how do they do that? They basically throw them from a cliff and then cut off the left palm and put it on the house and hang it on the house, on the door of the house where, you know, the family lives, in order to say it's that is how you restore the honor. It's crazy, I know. But still now, hundreds of bodies are unclaimed in the morgues, you know, in Baghdad and stuff, that that have that kind of signature, of honor killing signature. The work of Yanar, this is her name, is Yanar Mohammed, it's very important because it's not just a hub that provides services to this woman, but the idea is to empower them. So through the organization, they have classes, they have, you know, like English classes, literacy courses, and those kind of things. And then for them to be ready and help other women in their same conditions. And then the third one is Salai Ghaffar. She's a politician, first woman spokesperson of the Solidarity Party of Afghanistan, Hamas Taghi, the only secular party in Afghanistan. And she goes around, I think, you know, the Afghanistan part is one that surprised me the most, not just for the conditions, but yeah, for the condition and how hard these women need to fight back. You know, I am sorry to say, but America went in Afghanistan claiming they would liberate women. Today, in 17 years later, you know, 87% of women actually experience violence in their lifetime. And just 14%, 1/4, can actually read and write. So it's a crazy, crazy situation. Also because, you know, you have to fight with a very kind of patriarchal society, a very narrow-minded part. And anyway, and Salai goes around Afghanistan, even where, you know, the government doesn't, you know, isn't able to reach, and help women, and not just women, but everyone, basically, to, you know, from... that they want water, courses, schools. It is a very, very difficult situation. Of course, you know, in your intro said, you know, it's a very different kind of struggle. But you also have to think that that kind of struggle, Western and a European woman already went through that, because, you know, it wasn't, you know, this year is 100 year of the suffragette, in which, you know, they wanted the voting rights for women. So it's like a kind of a path.
I mean, it's more than that even. I mean, we went through that not 100 years ago. We went through it, you know, 500 years ago.
No, not 500. I'm sorry, Jack. Not
like,
500.
Like Afghanistan? Like, when was the last time, you know, the Western world was in that sort of state?
Actually, for I'm talking about women's rights. You know, I gave the... Now in Afghanistan, women can vote. Like, up to 8 years ago, in a lot of countries, women couldn't vote. So
up until, you know, recently, we had things like, it was actually legal to beat your wife 100 years ago in America.
Exactly.
And we're also going to get into later on Saudi Arabia, but the recent right for women to drive in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I feel that that is a little bit of...
PR
propaganda for the West, in order to masquerade a different kind of, you know, regime. Because, you know, I was reading actually yesterday about a woman who dared to drove around Saudi Arabia, suddenly disappeared. So, I mean, you know.
Yeah.
In Afghanistan, for instance, it's not a question what the law says. It's a question, like, let's say a woman in Afghanistan starts driving tomorrow in Kabul. She can. I'm not saying she can't, but she will be so much harassed from all the drivers around.
Oh, sure.
That she will think twice.
What's the point
before,
of it? Yeah, why, you know, even do it?
Why even do it?
make a good Instagram video, though, right?
What?
A woman driving, like this in Saudi Arabia. It's like, look at these women are taking their veils off and driving cars. Like, okay,
you know, I said to our security team in Afghanistan, you know, if you're tired, don't worry, I can drive because I drove in Syria. And they were like, no, this is not possible here. You can't. No, literally, you can't.
So how did you come in contact with these three particular women?
I met Yanar Mohammed in 2015 when she was in New York to speak at a Security Council at the UN. And I was fascinated straight away in our, you know, talk and interview. I actually wrote an article about her and, you know, about her work. She described these shelters, so she described, you know, the work that they do in Baghdad. And so this is how I met her. And Rajda Falat, I knew about her because, you know, traveling in the region for work as a journalist, I knew about her. And then also Joy Lawrence, that person you had on the podcast.
Yes.
Stayed with her for
photographer,
a while.
Photographer,
amazing photographer. And he talked to me about her and saying she was the real deal. And he was right. She is the real deal. She's very shy. Nobody really knows about her background so much for reasons that we can get into. But and so, you know, I was fascinated by this person who was on the forefront on fighting ISIS, but gave so little interviews or never really talked about her life and what she's doing. So this is why I selected her. And the third one, actually the Kurds told me about Hambastagi first. And they said, you know, we know about this woman, about Salai Ghaffar. You should look into her. So we started Skype conversations to understand, you know, what really she was doing, because I tend to prep all my subjects before, of course, and to understand who they are and if they're real, if it's propaganda and whatever. And she is amazing. She's incredible. And she has no fear whatsoever. She's ready to sacrifice her personal life, and she does sacrifice her personal life every day. And so we left.
I also assume being on film and being a part of a documentary there is not, they don't see it as like a glamorous thing. I want to become famous or anything like that. I think if anything, they'd prefer to go under the radar. So were any of the women reluctant to be a part of a film?
I think that there is a security issue that we shouldn't, you know, overlook, because it's very important, especially for someone like Yanar or Salai, that they are not technically at war, or although they are.
And Yanar's organization, too, you said before, it was like a semi-clandestine organization because it's illegal to operate, to run women's shelters in Iraq.
Yes, exactly. But they also have other projects and stuff. So I wouldn't call it a reluctancy in that in the fact that they didn't want to be on camera. But also you have to bear in mind it's very different to be on camera for a documentary than for, you know, a news piece. Because we stayed with them for a long time. That means waking up every day together, eating every meal together, you know, be filmed all the times. And you can see the differences when you start filming somebody and then at the end of the shooting, like 2-3 weeks later, depends, because they have to get used of the camera. So this, you know, was an important part of my job, is to make sure that they were at ease, you know, that they weren't saying stuff just for the camera. And one trick is to always have the camera out so they don't distinct anymore when he's recording and when he's not. But I think that another reluctant, you know, and the people around the minor characters of the film, so the woman that are helping, you know, the protagonist, and the community of women that they created around themselves, they were a little bit wary and scared, you know, like, especially in Iraq, there were women who escaped their families and stuff. And they said to me, I can't be on camera because if my parents or my family see me, family sees me, then, you know, they will look for me and they will try to kill me. So, you know, you have to be very, very careful when you shoot, like, you know, delicate and sensitive subjects like them.
The thing, too, I wanted to ask you about was, you know, this is three countries, three different languages. It's a kind of a cross-cultural piece that, from my perspective, maybe I'm wrong, but, I mean, I don't see that sort of work attempted. It's very ambitious in that sense.
Indeed, it is. You know, we'll see what the critics say about the film. But initially, it was Iraq, Syria, and Somalia. But then, you know, the more I thought about it, you know, of course, it took me about more than 2 years to do, finish, write, you know, the documentary, which is actually quite fast for a documentary.
Sure. And especially also with the language barrier, the translations. I mean, you're translating, as he said, I believe, what, three different languages?
More, actually, because you have Arabic, Kurdish, two different kind of Kurdish. Then you have Pashto, you have Dari, which are different languages. And then, well, you have English, so it's like five different languages.
So did you have to bring in several translators for the...
editing?
Yeah.
Yes. But the editing is the, you know, I think that your question was more related on, you know, like, why these three countries kind of thing.
Well, I mean, yeah, you could answer that question, but also it just strikes me as something that's not often done because of the language barrier and the cultural barrier.
No, it's a very ambitious project also because, you know, having a film crew in these three countries that are conflict areas. So with all the problems that you face when you travel, and you know very well, when you travel in those regions, you have to be careful. You have to prepare yourself. You know, there is a whole, you know, tip sheet that you should, you know, follow for you, not just for your own protection, but for the crew protection. So that was, you know, usually documentary, they follow one person. This is how documentaries are done. What I've tried to do, in a way, it's a bridge between the journalistic world and the documentary and cinema. Because the number three, is usually when you go to, like, journalism school or even in your work, your editor.
Even novels and things have a beginning, a middle, and an end, you know,
no,
it's storytelling.
Editor would always ask you, you know, who are your sources? And if you have three people saying the same thing, that means that you can write about it. So this is the idea behind the three women. The three women is three very different perspective because, you know, the characters are very different. So one is a commander, a general military. The second one is an activist and the third one is a politician. So is how do you, can you see, you know, it's like there are different ways to do the same thing, to try to achieve the same things, which is gender equality, feminist revolution in those countries. And I thought it was interesting to challenge the idea of this, you know, poor woman in these three countries that have so many similarities in so many different ways. What does it mean? You know, it's like you have U.S. intervention in the three of them, you have ISIS and terrorism in the three, all of three. You know, you have, if you look at ranking of international ranking about, you know, what are the worst places to be a woman? Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan are there, and they are always on the top list. So this
I would assume Pakistan probably way up there. Pakistan probably.
Yes. Saudi Arabia, Egypt.
Saudi Arabia not that much. Yeah, he's still there, but not
should
as
be,
bad.
But
it should be. Now India has reached number one lately because of the attacks, because of the rape, because of many different things.
Probably people are becoming more aware and it's getting more press coverage.
Absolutely,
than
yes.
Has in the past.
But Pakistan, you hear about that same Wahhabi sect of Islam that you were talking about earlier, yeah. Women getting acid thrown in faces and, you know.
Yeah, it's all coming from, you know, the same Somalia, you have some African countries. It's not that everything gets great, you know, but this was the thought of it. Now, you know, it is a very ambitious project for that reason, because we traveled in these three countries. And also, of course, these challenges came up in the editing as well. You know, I don't want to give it too much away, but, you know, the story intertwine and with one another. And it's about a feminist revolution, in no matter where it is, you know, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan. That's what the film is about.
I think some of the footage itself, even beyond the story of these three people, there's the footage that, particularly out of Afghanistan and Syria, is just mind-boggling. It looks like you're on an alien planet. I think people will be pretty interested to see that.
Yeah, also because it's like you don't see that kind of footage, you know. It's like there is a scene in which Sly, which is one of my personal favorite scene, she is talking to a group of like dozens of women, and they're all wearing burqa. And they are saying, you know, our sons can go to school, but our daughters, no, we want them to go to school. We know the school is, you know, the first step to get equality, to have a freer life, you know, and the men prevent them to go to school. And it's very interesting, at least from my point of view, to see, you know, from both from like a plot point of view and also from an image wise, it's something that you don't see very often at all.
You know, I was going to ask you about this, and it's a little bit off topic, but because you're mentioning the burqa and stuff like that, I'm wondering your take on how the U.S. has handled Muslim immigration and equality as opposed to Europe. You know, in America, here in New York City, you see women in the streets wearing burqas, and it's a...
Well, not burqas, but...
You have? I have.
Wearing a burqa?
Absolutely. When I lived in Philadelphia, I would see it all the time, but there's been times in the subway I've seen it, yes.
I've never seen a woman wearing a burqa.
I have. And when I was in Michigan, I saw it a lot, but you know I have.
I've seen like the hijab and...
The hijab. I've seen full burqa definitely a handful of times in New York City.
Holy shit.
I've seen people with their kids...
I mean, what do you mean by burqa is blue? The blue one.
Everything, you can see everything.
In Saudi Arabia, they wear the big black one.
But that's another thing. That's not called burqa.
Okay, but it's this women wearing garbage bags.
Okay, but it's not the same.
I'm just thinking about where you could barely see anything but the eyes. And I know that there's typically different traditional, you know, attire. But my point being, more than a hijab, you're not seeing the woman's face. I've seen it many times. I'm actually surprised you guys haven't.
When you said to me burqa, I've never seen a burqa. Burqa is a typical light blue, and it's worn just in Afghanistan usually because it's the
Then I might
Taliban.
Be thinking of the black, but
this
we're
is called the abaya or the niqab. Yes, I saw a woman in niqab. I saw a woman in niqab in London. I saw a woman in niqab, but, you know, this is a small minority that wear that.
My point being, though, in America, you have the freedom to do so. There's been some debate over whether you can wear one in a driver's license photo. And state by state, they've had different laws on this. Certain states have tried to ban women wearing them because there have been women involved in criminality who, you know, in a license photo, you can't tell who they are at all. So I understand that debate. However, we're not having the same debate as in parts of Europe where they're talking about literally banning the burqa. I'm wondering, just from a feminist perspective, like, how do you think this type of thing should be handled? Are you okay with a country saying we want to ban the burqa?
This is a very slippery question that you're asking me right
sure.
now. So I think, you know, the handling of immigration in the U.S., it's better than other places. You know, you have to try to compromise on several different issues. Personally, I don't like those niqab, hijab, well, the hijab, whatever, it doesn't really matter to me because it's just really the hair and it's...
Sure, and there's women I've talked to, you know, that worked with me when I was over at Sirius and other places that do wear the hijab, and by no means, if you talk to them, are they what people would consider the stereotypical traditional Muslim women.
Yeah.
Some of them drink, some of them have had sex, you know, premaritally. And yet,
goodness, no.
Yeah. And yet the, you know, and I've spoken to these women and some of them just say, like, I believe in the idea of modesty. I like this certain thing, but do I follow everything in the Quran? Absolutely not. So I actually see the hijab as like a very different thing than, you know, covering the entire face.
It's like nuns, you know, nuns, they just cover their hair in a way. It's not really the same thing, but, you know, the concept is very similar. Also, you know, in Christian culture, until really recently, meaning 20, 25 years ago, and even now, if you go to southern Italy, they actually wear a black veil, you know, to go to church. So you know, every single religion has a different kind of
tradition. It's funny you mention that because, like, I see, like, the memes on social media about, you know, showing, like, side by side, and, like, traditional Islamic culture, and it's a woman wearing the burqa. Traditional Italian culture, and it's a woman wearing, like, a bikini. And it's like, no, yeah. That's not really traditional Italian culture.
Russia propaganda.
if you have to, like, if you go back and, like, actually read the history of Italy and of Europe, that's not traditionally how women dress.
Italy is a place that had, until really recently, meaning 40 years ago, what they're called the wedlock, you know, for if someone got raped, you know, they would force her to marry the offender. So, I mean, you know, it's like we shouldn't think of ourselves as too much forward compared to some of the places because you know, traditions come from a very kind of segregated perspective, especially between men and women.
But we've evolved relatively quickly compared to these other cultures. I mean, you know, this is off topic from the feminist stuff, but I was actually watching on YouTube. I don't even remember how I came across it, but it's just crazy to me to think, like, in my grandparents' time, there was a time you would turn on the TV and it was like Amos and Andy and stuff like that, these white people in blackface imitating black actors because Broadway didn't want black actors because it would, like, make white people in the theater uncomfortable to see a black person acting. And it is insane to think, like, this was not that long ago.
No, it wasn't. And, you know, and if you think in the 60s, you know, all the civil rights movement and, you know, black people wanting to go to university, to school and stuff, you know, all these, you know, like the protesters, the ones that wanted a segregated America, they're still here around, well and live, you know.
Yeah.
So
Rosa Parks died not that long ago, you know, exactly. People like that.
So we should be very careful about when we judge other culture in that sense because we have our own fault. Of course, it's a work in progress. So to go back to your question, you know, it's like, for me, I wish, you know, it would be an individual choice to wear those garments. But unfortunately, often it's not. That is my problem with niqab, burqa, abaya. And that, you know, it's like if it is a woman choice and thinking, you know, I want to be this and that, I don't know why. That's a different question.
Sure.
You know?
In the Western world, I mean, there's this big debate, I think, or not even a debate, but there's this theme within feminism that it's institutional. It's a social construct. The patriarchy itself being a social construct. I mean, aren't these women essentially victims of this social construct and that they've been generationally conditioned to wear this sort of whatever kind of garment it is?
Absolutely. But I can tell you the opposite argument of this. You know, like when you see children, literally children dressed up like, I mean, I'm talking about girls, but, you know, dressed up as beauty pageant, a beauty queen, and, you know, exploiting their bodies in a way, yeah. You know, it's the other side of it.
Yeah.
You have the opposite.
That's not very common, but...
But, I mean, like, in America, you have, like, beauty pageants for, like, 5, 6, 7, and...
Yeah, and it's glamorized. And you know, glamorized. Even this, like, Honey Boo Boo show that was, like, giant.
That's like a creepy subculture where all these, like, middle-aged guys are in the audience, like, breathing heavy.
It's horrible.
It is terrible. And I actually do think, you know, it would be a whole nother topic, but, like, the over-sexualization of children in America... It definitely is a problem. Like, there's these pop stars who come out, they're like, are 14 and they have them barely wearing anything, you know, and then people are waiting for them to become 18. It is very creepy. It's very strange.
There is a very kind of, this is one of the first documentary I saw here in New York. The name is skipping now. And it's this journalist who just had a daughter and she started looking at the media and the social construct around, you know, girls and what they should look like, how they should, you know, present themselves, how they should, yeah, in general is trying to conform the way they look. And this put a lot of pressure on girls. And this is why you have anorexia, bulimia, because they don't like themselves. They don't think, you know, they're beautiful enough to have a success. And well, I think it's a very, very well done documentary that analyzes how the media pushes the stereotype of how a woman should look like.
It's also worth mentioning, though, that, you know, a lot of girls get that, or young women get that impression from the fashion industry and from the media and from periodicals and media that is not necessarily produced by heterosexual men. That size zero model is not it's not something that the average man is into. So it's this odd this odd position that, you know, women are like given this this media that says that this is what you're supposed to look like, but that's not even something that I think most men find desirable.
I don't know about that. I think it depends. It depends on a lot of different things. But nonetheless, this is the idea that you're giving to younger generations, that they should look like, I'm making it up, Giselle. Otherwise, they're not worth it.
You know what's interesting, though? We're living in a weird time where that look is glamorized, and then also because of, like, the Kim Kardashian, Nicki Minaj, like, extreme plastic surgery of getting a giant ass, that's also glamorized. And they're both completely unrealistic for the average woman, and you know, it's kind of just bizarre that you know, the average natural woman, this is, you know, you just have these two extremes of the woman who's like 80 pounds or the woman like Kim Kardashian who's blatantly done, you know, massive amounts of plastic surgery, to especially her sister, who doesn't even look like, you know, who's a white woman who looks more like her sister, who is you know, Armenian, and the father of Kardashian was Armenian. Either way, the younger sister has two white parents, you know what I mean? So she shouldn't look like her sister, but she's gotten so much plastic surgery that they almost look identical. Jeez. Like, it's just, you know, it's pretty crazy. I know we're going, like, way off topic here.
No, also, I don't know the Kardashian that well, so I don't know who's the
younger
sister.
You're like, what
sister
are you watching, Ian?
Yeah, exactly.
You know what else I wanted to ask you about, besides this film, is you recently did a TED Talk in Milan, and I wanted to hear all about that experience and what you actually spoke about, because it was in Italian, correct?
Yeah, it was. It's a TEDx, and it was a great opportunity, honestly. And I talked about the film, you know, and more or less what we covered in 15 minutes. I mean, I'm sure that most of the listeners are familiar with what a TED Talk is, but, yes, you know, you have a format, and you have to stay within that 15 minutes. And
some of them are a lot longer, right, I thought? Or
17, 18 at the top. You know, yeah, you can. You have that. A couple of minutes that you can go on. I'm not too sure how long was mine, probably 16. So, and it was in this theater in the middle of Milan, and 1,550 people participated. I never talked in front of so many people in my life. I closed the day, which was great. Great. Yeah, it was very nice. Although, you know, waiting around whole day for you to go up on stage is not the greatest. Especially, you know, people don't know and do not realize about me, but I really do not like to be in the spotlight so much. This is why I like radio, and this is why I like coming and hang out with you guys, because we're here just chatting amongst us and everything.
That's what you say now.
No. You are the star of the family, Jack. It's not me. So, anyway.
And I've heard that said before. It's like a shy person's medium, though, because I've spoken in front of people and extremely uncomfortable, but I am comfortable doing this. I know what you mean.
Exactly. So, you know, I had to prepare a lot. I had one coach with whom I did rehearsal, you know, because sometimes people go on stage and they freeze. And you don't want to have, you don't want that to happen, you know, because you have this opportunity and that's it. It's not that you can remake it and stuff. And so we worked a lot. And at the end, you know, at the end of the day, I woke up on stage. Walked up on stage and I kind of went black. I don't remember anything. I know that I talked and I spoke, and now I'm going to say a very cute thing, because the only time I stumbled, actually twice, but the first one is because I saw my mom and I was like, oh, I got all very excited about it. So I couldn't find my words anymore, and then I had to reconcentrate. But, you know, at the end, it was great. It was a great experience, a lot of different, you know, emotions. But But funny enough, when I finished the talk about these three amazing women, about the film and everything else, this really young guy walked up to me and say, you know, I want to talk to you. And I said, yes, sure. He's like 19, was 19. And he said, well, you know, I'm having this huge debate with my sister about women staying in the kitchen. And I was like, what do you mean? Is it so bad for a woman to be in the kitchen? And I was puzzled by the question from such a young man, you know. And I was like, well, it's not a bad thing per se. It's a, you know, it's, but it has to be, again, their own choice. You know, I don't have anything, you know, against housewives or women, you know, that take care of the house and the family and stuff. But it has to be their own choice. Sometimes, no, most of the times now, it's not their own choice. Yeah. So, you know, it's a, again, it's a difficult topic.
Some women want to wear pearls and vacuum, Benny.
You?
No, I said some, you? I've said some
you?
Women.
Actually, you want to know what's funny? Jack and I,
yeah,
off air, had a whole discussion about the stereotype of, like, the man who's, you know, the single father who's taking care of their kid and doesn't have a job. And, you know, it, for some reason, it is this whole double standard. If you're a man with a kid who doesn't work and maybe your wife works or something, you're looked at as like a lazy bum. And it is interesting.
I told Dean I'm comfortable with it. I'll stay at home, take care of the kids.
Yes.
You work on documentaries.
Yeah.
We could do that, but you have to vacuum better. Otherwise, it doesn't work out.
The other interesting, I think it's a stereotype, there's like this image people have in their mind about women in the military, particularly these women now who are increasingly wanting to go into special operations units. And I was reading an article about a young woman. I'm sorry, I can't remember her name.
I saw the picture, like tatted up.
She looks like a pirate. And yeah. I mean that as a compliment. She looks like a badass. She has like pirate tattoos on her chest because she's wearing like a bikini in this photo. Her and her husband has all these tattoos and everything. And I think a lot of Americans have this vision in their mind of like the G.I. Jane, who like she's going to be soft and feminine and cute and but also be strong and empowered and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no. The women who go and like become Rangers and Navy SEALs and Green Berets, and in this case is MARSOC, Marine Special Operations, they're going to be like tough, badass women. Like,
yeah.
They're not going to be cutesy, this typical version of feminists. Like they're going to look more and act more like guys, like the behavior we associate with men, because that's the environment.
Yeah, and also, you know, it's like, I would have loved, not that that's actually untrue, but, you know, if you put me into Ranger school right now, I think I'll fail after 2 hours, maybe one.
Can you do pull-ups, Benny?
No, I can't.
Okay, you won't make it past the PT test, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I can run, but not that much. Also, I'm a certain age now, so I cannot compete with 20 years something, guys and girls, but you know, I think you're right. And sometimes, you know, women who want to go into ranger school, SF schools, or whatever, it's like they're really mindset on that. And I'm sure that, you know, physically they're very prepared. And if they're not, they will not make it through the PT test.
Not to mention, I think this is a discussion that's been had on the podcast before, but aren't there certain, you know, branches of special operations where it's kind of like they look the other way if you're on steroids and that type of thing? And there's probably guys in SF.
I'd say across the board, they kind of look the other way.
So if you have a woman in special operations who's taking steroids, in a way, as crazy as it sounds, they're almost slightly transitioning to becoming a man because you're putting male hormones in yourself. That's why, you know, not to be graphic here, but like the woman's, you know, clitoris enlarges and stuff like that when they're on steroids because they're becoming more manly. So, I mean, if you put a woman on steroids that looks like, you know, Chris Cyborg from UFC.
Who's, well, the military does not put women on steroids.
But if they choose to be and they choose to go through Ranger school.
They want to become more men. I think they just want to become stronger and compete better.
But in effect, they do become more manly because they start growing more hair. I mean, they're putting male hormones in their system.
I mean, I don't know.
Their choice.
I also don't know. Like, I've never used steroids. I mean, there's...
Neither have I, clearly. Neither have any of us.
Yeah.
No, none of us.
I mean, there's tons of guys using it. And part of it is... I'm more. It's not so much operationally honest. To just be completely frank about it, I think it has more to do with vanity than that. There's an operational necessity. I mean, I went through it. I was never on steroids. Guys who are smaller than I am.
I mean, you know. I think it's just safe to say if you're a woman on steroids, it'd be easier to get through Rangers.
I'm sure it also depends on the specifics, on what type of steroids you're using. And that's what we've said on the podcast before. Is like I think that the military should do more research into it and figure out what are like the medically safe, responsible ways to use steroids, and maybe look at that like institutionalizing it rather than having all of these people do it illegally. And some people really fuck themselves up. I mean, they fuck their bodies up because it's not medically supervised.
And here's the thing. If you're talking about having transgenders in the military, that involves putting female or male hormones into your system, which is the exact same thing as steroids, but done for a completely different reason.
Why do you have this fascination with women on steroids? Can you explain?
No, the reason being, if you're a woman going through Ranger school, going through BUDS, I would think it would be a huge edge over a natural woman. It's just something I've, you know, thought about.
I don't know. I think it depends on which kind of woman. I mean, take my sister. My sister, she's very strong. She's way taller than I am. She did all her life kickboxing and stuff. I don't think, you know, that she would have at the time, not now, because now she had two children and everything, so much need of steroid.
I love how this just goes off as a recording, probably a probably some fire drill thing. But anyway, you can keep talking.
All right. So anyway, doesn't matter. The woman on steroids.
No, but if she did take steroids on top of that, she would have an edge. That's why, you know, powerlifters and that type of thing.
Yeah.
And you know, if you talk about, you know, we've had on the podcast before Kristen Beck. You know, Kristen Beck going through BUDS compared to the average transgender man, woman, however you want to say it. Kristen Beck, however you want to label this person, is a massive person. And is far stronger than, you know, myself. Or
I don't know. I mean, I honestly don't really care that much about the whole transgender thing in general. It's like 0.03% of the population. The amount of them who are then going to go into the military is like so minuscule. I mean, I don't know. It's not something I stress out so much about.
No, I hear you. But it's been addressed on the podcast before. Okay. You know what else I want to ask you before we get into Saudi Arabia? Sure. You mentioned a comic book that he's working on. I had no idea about this.
You're doing a spoiler here. Yes, I'm writing a graphic novel with
Did he get you into comic books or?
No, not comic books, graphic novel.
It's similar. Come on.
Similar.
Similar. If I go to the comic book store.
Penny's so fancy with her graphic novel.
I mean, it's a non-fiction, you know, it's a little bit different.
Sure.
And, you know, actually, my first graphic novel that I read, it was Mouse. I don't know if you ever read it. Mouse?
I'm not a comic book guy, so no. Jack.
I haven't read it. I remember it.
Very beautiful. It's about World War II and, you know, the Holocaust specifically. And anyway, and I always thought it was a great medium to tell a story or, you know, to even a younger kind of generation. So the story that we are writing down, it's of Islam Mitat. She is a Moroccan woman who in 2014 decided that she really wanted to go and study fashion design in London. But her parents from Morocco, they said to her, listen, the only way for you to go to London is to actually get married. Okay, fine. So she goes online, you know, they're kind of, you know, Tinder or whatever, it's called Muslima.net, which is an app for dating and marriage within the Muslim world. And she meets online this guy called Hamid, originally Afghani, but a British citizen. So I don't want to give too much away, but, you know, they get married, and Hamid say to her, listen, why don't we go for our honeymoon in Turkey? This was June, July 2014. And she said, yeah, sure, why not, you know? So they arrive in Gaziantep, which is at the border between Syria and Turkey. And there, without a word of explanation, he basically put her into a safe house of ISIS. So this 19-year-old girl, she finds herself, first time that she goes out from Morocco, she finds in an ISIS kind of safe house in Gaziantep. At the time, really, ISIS wasn't that big. So, they, you know, nobody really knew about ISIS, and especially her. So from that moment on, she started this journey within the Islamic State, and where she just tried to survive. And it's a good ending story. So, you know, she survives, she escaped, and now she's back in Oujda. But it's about this.
Who's doing the illustration?
Me.
Oh, really?
No, I'm joking.
I didn't know you were an illustrator.
No, I'm not an illustrator. I'm working with another Italian woman. She's based in Italy mainly, and she's great. She's the same one who did the flyer for our film. So she's a great illustrator. She's young. She's extremely talented, and I'm very excited to be working with her, honestly.
I would assume this is entirely different than any other medium you've done, in that it's like, I wouldn't know the first thing about how to get a comic book distributed, where people are going to be able to buy it. You know, like, it's probably a tough thing to get into.
Yeah, it's mainly like any other books in a way, but you have like selected publishers that deal just with graphic novels and that kind of things, especially nonfiction. This is the first time I'm doing something like that. It's not that different from a documentary, because now we are writing the script. So on one side, you have to imagine the drawings, the illustrations, and then make it combine those with text. So it's not that different, but still a little bit.
And the Italian and overall European comic book industry is totally different than in the United States, where like we put new comic books out every week. In Italy, you have an artist who just works on his one comic book like all year, his one, you know, 100-page graphic novel, and then it comes out. So it's like every book they do has to be like a grand slam.
So I don't know as much as you of comic books, but because comic is slightly different, I know what I read for the longest time, which was Diabolik, Julia, those kind of...
That's weekly, right?
Yeah, those are all weekly. And then you have graphic novels. So graphic novel, I think, kind of in France, they do a lot of graphic and different novels, and I think it started like... with, again, Mouse was one of the first graphic novel in that sense that tried to tell a very serious story, like the Holocaust, and illustrate that. And it's very interesting. Check it out, because it is a very, very well-done work. Obviously, he's, like, super famous author and everything, but it's just very different. But just to give you an example, you know, it's like in Italy... what they think is a successful graphic novel when it's sold, because, you know, numbers are extremely different, 3,500 copies.
That's crazy.
It is crazy. This is to get back to the cost. But also because you have such a smaller, you know, market,
yeah,
that everything is slightly different.
I was reading somewhere that Batman comes out every week, sells about 30,000.
Where?
In the United States.
In the United States.
And that's considered a small number.
Yeah.
Like for a big comic book like that.
Huh. Will this be distributed in the U.S.? Or?
No, now we're starting in Italy, and then we'll see.
Okay. Because I think it would be so cool if, you know, I walk over to Midtown Comics with Jack, and there's your comic. I would love to see that.
Maybe
not
one,
comic.
Maybe
I should say graphic novel. I keep saying comic.
Graphic novel. Come on. Words are important
yes.
here.
Translating it into English, I mean, that wouldn't. I don't think it would be too hard.
Oh, well, let's proceed with step by step, you know?
All right, the other thing that I wanted to get into was what's going on in Saudi Arabia. Now, President Erdogan earlier today, I believe, or it may have been yesterday, of Turkey, said that the murder of the journalist in Saudi Arabia, Jamal am I saying his name right, by the way? Khashoggi? Either way, everybody knows who I'm talking about. The journalist, though, in Saudi Arabia, he's claiming that it was planned days in advance, and we're trying to figure out how we're going to handle this, because as much as we read these horrible things coming out of Saudi Arabia, they are our allies in the U.S. And it's a very strange dynamic because a lot of the things that we're fighting, we at least claim to be fighting for in Iraq, in Afghanistan, are the exact same things going on legally in Saudi Arabia, as we talked about before, with driving, things like that.
Do you want to start? I'll start.
Well, yeah. I mean, this whole thing, I wrote an article about it yesterday, but it's like this crazy, like, slow roll reality television show they're turning it into, where it's like every day, a little new piece. There's a new episode. There's a new piece of micro content. You get another little piece of the mystery, the little story. It's so weird. And I mean, I think the government of Turkey is doing that initially. Like, they're playing this out as long as they can. And I think they're going to, like, yesterday, the news was that a member of the Saudi embassy actually wore this guy's clothes and left and walked around Istanbul to make it look on security cameras as if the journalist had left, and you know, he had left the embassy. Of course, it was a really amateurish attempt at a ruse. But it's like every day there's another little piece of information you get.
So I think that this is absolutely, and I think that Erdogan is doing that on purpose, also because I think that he's trying to put leverage on Saudi Arabia. So I think we need to make a couple of step backs about this, because Turkey, do you remember, I don't know how long it was, but 6, 7, 8 months ago, there was Saudi Arabia and Qatar entering into this huge dispute about money.
Yeah.
And about other things, about, you know, foreign policy and stuff. And Turkey and Qatar are very much allied. So what's happening now is an attempt from Erdogan, who is leaking out all the information, because this is, you know, the Turkish government doing it. And I was like, you know, thinking about this, you know, why is he doing this? And then sometimes the reasons are way more simpler, but just to put leverage on Saudi Arabia, weaken the regime and the kingdom, and in order to get something else out of it. And he's masterminding the whole things, and I think that, you know, he's doing it very well. This doesn't take away the horrifying murder of a journalist, you know, in Turkey. Not that the irony of all of this, you know, is that Turkey doesn't have free press. Turkey, you know, has been jailing journalists for over 2 years and, like, shut down all the free press and everything. And now that Erdogan is lecturing Saudi Arabia on how you should do stuff, I found it quite ironic, honestly. And nobody has been, like, talking about this. Although, like, you know, some critics within Turkey, they say, ah, but there is a huge difference between a jailing journalist and murdering them. And I'm like, is there? Really? Yeah, of course, you know, killing somebody. But it's like, in terms of free press, no, there isn't much journalism.
Well, I mean, Turkey kills people all the time. The Turkish government, I mean, they've widely suspected to have set off bombs in public places. I mean, they're an extremely repressive regime. And with Erdogan consolidating power over the last couple of years to essentially set himself up as dictator for life. Or our friend Sam Faddis once described Erdogan. Or no, it wasn't Sam Faddis. It was our friend Zagros up in the mountains, who's a member of the PKK. But I mentioned this to Sam Faddis, what the party had told me. But anyway, this guy Zagros said that Erdogan has neo-Ottoman ambitions. And when I mentioned that to Faddis, he just started laughing. He's like, that's probably the most accurate summary of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Turkey is playing its own game. But also, I think that there is never one explanation for something. I'm also sure. I think that if we want to go down into the conspiracy road, MBS, you know, has been, MBS is
the Mohammed bin Salah.
Yes, as in, you know, the prince who is the minister of defense and everything, did the purge of his own family and arrested a bunch of them for corruption, he said. And it's been said that Khashoggi, the journalist, was very close to some of those members. And this is why he started to be very critical, not that he wasn't before, of course he was, but about this whole managing of the new way that the kingdom is going. And I feel that somehow they've been trying to frame MBS to, you know, give him a warning about what was going on. What is sure now that all these, like, restricted team, how do you say, like, all the people working with him.
His assistants and aides,
they've all been fired. So it's coming, like, is now all by himself. But it's a great way to isolate him.
It's a palace coup.
Yeah. It could, well, I don't know about that, but, you know.
You had mentioned to me, too, that it, the reason why Turkey may have it out for Saudi Arabia plays into the Syrian Democratic Forces in North Syria, or, yeah, Northern Syria, because Saudi Arabia is part of the coalition that makes up Operation Inherent Resolve.
Yes, and somebody was pointing it out to me, and we couldn't find really evidence of it, not yet at least, that, you know, around the time the Khashoggi death disappearance at first on October 2nd, there were a lot of, you know, articles about Saudi Arabia giving to the U.S. $100 million. I don't know if you remember that. But then it was explained to me by sources that that $100 million is not for the U.S. or for trade agreements or whatever. It is part of the efforts of the coalition. So it was something that the Saudi were supposed to give to the U.S., who then turned that money towards the Syrian Democratic Forces. Of course, the Syrian Democratic Forces, the biggest part of the Syrian the SDF, they are Kurdish fighters. And that amount of money in their hands scare a lot Erdogan, and should be, you know. I think that this is could be another way to look at this issue and why Erdogan is so adamant about, you know, his criticism, let's to say the least, towards Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I mean, it's a one of these complicated geopolitical situations. I mean, probably everything going on between Saudi Arabia and Iran plays into it, and everything going on in Yemen, which we talked about on the last podcast, where you have Qatar on one side, and then you have Saudi Arabia and the UAE on the other. There's a lot of pieces that play into it. But
by the way, do you know if the embargo is still going on for Qatar? Because they placed him under the Qatar under embargo.
Who is they?
Saudi Arabia.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And I'm not sure. I have to suspect, because this whole thing is like so sloppy and over the top, that they probably didn't intend to kill him when he came in that day. I mean, I probably believe that, and not that I know for a fact, that he came in and they probably tried to intimidate him, and probably some of those idiots got out of hand and overdid it, and they ended up killing him.
Yes, but how come there was a doctor as well?
I don't
with the team. You know, there was not the doctor. How do you call the doctor?
He was like he was some sort of a doctor. I don't think he was a coroner, but he was also somebody who does like setting up field hospitals
and
stuff.
I understand what you're saying. I think that sometimes intelligence operations are run very badly, and you know about them because they're badly run, and so something goes really wrong. But I don't know. I think in another way, maybe Saudi Arabia claims that he died on a fist fight, but you see, I mean, the guy was like 58, 60 something, and how can an operator choke somebody to death and do not realize that he's actually strangling them?
Well, that's a good question, and that goes back to the case that in Mali, where those two SEALs allegedly murdered Sergeant Melgar, the Green Beret there, mm-hmm. and one of them was a UFC fighter, former UFC fighter, and I have the same question. I mean, how can you be choking, especially if you're a professional UFC fighter, mixed martial arts fighter, and you get someone in a rear naked choke, and to choke the person out until they pass out, it can happen fairly quickly, but then to continuously choke them while they're passed out until they die, it's hard for me to believe that happens on accident.
I don't know. I don't have that kind of skills, so do not look at me, but I have to imagine that there must be some kind of training in which you know what is the limit
have just completely let your emotions take hold and you're in some sort of a panic. I mean, the person actually passes out and goes limp, and for you to just not realize that at all and continue to choke them out for another couple minutes, it just kind of defies belief at a certain point.
Exactly. This is what I'm trying to say, you know, how, and these things, you know, the official, the quote unquote official version that keeps on changing every day, not
every
just
hour.
From, not just from Turkey's side, but even from Saudi Arabian's side. I mean, it's so unbelievable.
I agree.
Well, yeah, they're floating out lie after lie, and just hoping one of them is going to stick, and then they'll be able to just, like, no comment at the death. But every lie keeps getting exposed, so they have to change their story, go to the next lie. It's like, man, this is a circus. Is this for real?
And Jack, I know you also wanted to get into this article before we wrap things up here. The Army stymied its own study of the Iraq War. This is from the Wall Street Journal. Came out yesterday, written by Michael Gordon.
Yeah, this is an interesting article I was just reading today. And it's basically about how the Pentagon drafted this report, and it's sort of like the Pentagon Papers, where they wanted to do like a full-blown historical review of the Vietnam War in that case. In this case, they wrote something. It's a 1,300-page document about the Iraq War from 2003, I think, right up to like 2009 or 2008, something like that. And they had like teams of experts poring over documents and interviewing people and all sorts of stuff. And now they've been dragging their feet on actually publishing the study because it makes some generals look pretty bad and it could tarnish their reputations. It's pretty incredible. And I just wanted to look over some of the key findings that are, because apparently the Wall Street Journal, they probably got a leaked copy of the report or a leaked summary of it when they wrote this article. Some of the key findings of it, the need for more troops. At no point during the Iraq War did commanders have enough troops to simultaneously defeat the Sunni insurgency and Iranian-backed Shiite militias. So it's interesting. It's saying that we never deployed the proper amount of troops there, that commanders in theater perpetually thought the war is going to be over in 18 months throughout the entire campaign. So we never sent enough troops over there. The failure to deter Iran and Syria. Iran and Syria gave sanctuary and support to Shiite and Sunni militants, respectively, and the U.S. never developed an effective strategy to stop this. That's true. We didn't do very many counter cross-border raids. There were only a couple. The amount of operations we did in Syria and Iran were like low. They were low level. There was never like a serious attempt to basically turn the tables on them. This is what happened, you know, in Vietnam, where the enemy was using Laos and Cambodia as a safe haven to launch operations into South Vietnam. And at least in those cases, we did make some efforts to try to stop that. Coalition warfare wasn't successful. The deployment of Allied troops had political value, but was largely unsuccessful because the Allies didn't send enough troops and limited the scope of the operations. So again, it's like these coalitions, like Operation Inherent Resolve. It's like, really, what are you guys doing? You know, and I mean, I think even like, you remember Dave Chappelle did that skit about it. We got a coalition of the willing, the Zulu nations, you know.
I think I do remember that. Yeah.
So, I mean, there were some coalition partners who have done and continue to do important work. You know, the Brits had Task Force Black, the SAS in Iraq. They did a lot of operations. There are some small countries who did important work and continue to do important work. I mean, Denmark, small, little Denmark. But they've gone on so many deployments. They've done a lot of stuff. And it's not their fault that the soldiers get hampered by their politicians back home. The Norwegians, all these different countries. But
not quite as small, but got to include Canada.
Canada has done. Canada goes on like every single peacekeeping operation that we're involved in. It's Holland, the Dutch, also involved. Considering it's such a small country that they're all over the world doing stuff. It's amazing. But then you have countries like South Korea, and the South Koreans had, from the onset of it, they said, we'll contribute troops, but caveat, not a single South Korean soldier can be hurt or killed throughout this entire campaign.
How can you give that kind of assurance?
So what they did was they said, okay, South Korea, we'll put you into Baghdad. And South Korea was like, nope. And they say, okay, we'll send you to Crit. South Korea is like, nope. So eventually it bounced around like that until we sent them to Erbil, which was like the safest place in Iraq, in the Kurdish territories. And the South Koreans were hemmed up on like a compound within a compound. They were like, it was a South Korean special forces and some other, you know, logistics guys or whatever. They literally could not leave the base. They were there purely for political grandstanding and maybe to develop some commercial relationships with the Kurds. That was it.
And what's sad is, I'm sure, because you've had, you know, you've met with these guys before and you talked about the similarity between American special operations and those guys. I'm sure they want to be in the action.
The South Korean special forces absolutely did. I've met with them. They want to do stuff. The Filipino special forces, they want to be kicking ass in Syria with us. Mm-hmm. It's not that the troops are bad. It's just that the political considerations are different. And especially in Europe, you have these like very shaky coalition governments. I had one guy who's a CIA contractor and he was telling me that they had planned this big operation. I think it was with Danish troops. Maybe it was with Swedes or something like that. I can't remember. But they were on the tarmac getting into the helicopters to go do this operation. And the commander of that Scandinavian Special Forces unit received a phone call from a member of parliament and said, no, you're shut down. Get off the helicopter. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, how can you operate in an environment like that when the politicians are that hands-on that they directly call the ground force commander, like, nope, done. Can't do that. So, yeah, that's when coalition warfare becomes a joke. National Guard needs more training. Yeah, that's a no-brainer. I mean, we feared the National Guard more than we feared the enemy over in Iraq because the National Guard was notorious for, like, the death blossom. Like they just hear gunfire somewhere off in the distance, and the National Guard just starts firing automatic gunfire in all directions. Wow. It was called the Death Blossom. Not that all National Guard units were like that, but some of them were pretty scary. The failure to develop self-reliant Iraqi forces, the U.S.-led effort to train and equip Iraqi forces was under-resourced for most of the war. A premature decision to transfer sovereignty to the Iraqis made it harder to blunt political pressure by Iraqi officials on Iraqi commanders. Like, this is the key, to me, this is the key finding of the entire thing, is that a policy decision was made by the Obama administration that we were leaving Iraq, and everything from there, shit just rolled downhill, and all the commanders on the ground then had to fit a square peg into a round hole, and they were basically forced and pressured to send up false reports to hire. I'm talking about like the lieutenants, the captains, the majors, to send up false reports to the generals and say, everything's good. The Iraqi forces are ready.
Yeah, but that's on them. It's not on Obama.
It is on Obama because he made a policy decision.
Yeah, but then if you have a lieutenant lying about what's going on the ground, that's on him.
I agree, but also this is how the situation works, and when a lieutenant sends up the report to hire, they will. And if hire doesn't like that report, are you sure, lieutenant?
Yeah, but
are you
still
sure that's what
right,
you want to
you know,
put?
That the military is
right,
you know,
but it's an incestuous system. They're telling the junior officers what they're supposed to say. This is the right answer to give.
Same things with weapons of mass destruction.
Well, not necessarily, because if the troops on the ground are saying there's no WMDs here. Now, then if the generals come back and say, no, you have to lie and say there were WMDs. Now it's a similar case. Mm-hmm. But like Sam Faddis, his team went into Iraq prior to the invasion, and he told his guys, his team, before they went in, he's like, look, if we find WMDs, so be it. We'll report that. But we are not going to massage the facts to fit the political agenda. And that's the U.S. military should have taken that same stance when they went as we were running a counterinsurgency operation and trying to transition sovereignty over to the Iraqi forces. They forced a round peg to fit in a square hole. The Iraqis were not ready for it. And then we pulled out. We said everything was kosher. We pulled out, and then ISIS came to town. And you can see the results. Ineffective detainee policy. the U.S. decided at the onset not to treat captured insurgents or militia fighters as prisoners of war and then never developed an effective way to handle detainees. Many Sunni insurgents were returned to the battlefield. Well, hell yeah, that happened, especially as we had to turn them over to the Iraqi courts. And the Iraqi judges were just like, whoop, right back into the ecosystem with you. And so we'd pick up the same guys over and over again. But also the United States had our detainee policy was shit too. I mean, I was somebody, one of the things I had to do was stand guard in what was then called the tactical interrogation facility. I could go on and on about it. It was a fucking joke.
You've spoken about it a little bit on the show before.
Yeah. They had contractors there using techniques that some might describe as torture.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a boogarab. It was much more professional than that. But what they're saying here is the conclusion is correct. We never had a real policy for handling detainees. They should have been treated as prisoners of war, most likely, and put into a more formalized process. And then the last one here, the last bullet point, democracy doesn't necessarily bring stability. U.S. commanders believed the 2005 Iraqi elections would have a calming effect, but those elections exacerbated ethnic and sectarian tensions. So look, when you crash a country, when you crash the party, collapse the government, implode the institutions of government, you know, some Jeffersonian democracy isn't just going to spring up out of nowhere.
Especially if you actually, you know, bring back people who haven't been in the country for 20 years and then say, okay, this is your country now, you know, run for office.
Yeah, which is what we're also trying to do in Libya right now. And also when you crash the political system, and you have people who don't have a cultural institutional knowledge of democracy, what their vision of democracy is, okay, I vote for my ethnic group. End of story. Yeah. I vote for my tribe. So it's a different way of viewing politics than we do in the United States. And I think the U.S. military was extremely naive about that fact.
But I think also the White House was extremely naive.
They were. No, absolutely.
You cannot export democracy in that way. I mean, there was a fight in both Europe and the United States to actually reach to democracy. And you need to have that. Otherwise, and then we change, adjust it to our own country, and you cannot just impose democracy.
But we keep doing it over and over again. And that's the book I'm reading right now, The Grand Delusion by John Mearsheimer, is about exactly that, how political liberalism has essentially taken over. And in the sense we use that term liberalism, I mean, George W. Bush would be a liberal in that sense, that we have this idea that we want to export our ideology across the world and that will make the world a better, safer place. And his book is essentially the counter narrative to that, saying that we've actually made a foreign policy disaster across the globe with this sort of ideological thinking.
Well, if you want to read the full article, it's at the Wall Street Journal. Army stymied its own study of the Iraq War. Wrapping things up here, be sure to check out Crate Club, the long-anticipated collaboration watch that we did with NFW Watches. Sorry, I actually saw it on Scott Whitner's Instagram, so you could check that out. It looks great. That's coming for premium tier members. We have different tiers of membership depending on how prepared you want to be, and gift options are available as well. We're going for 100% custom products in 2019, everything from sunglass cases to EDC bags and other manly products. It's a club for men, by men. You can check that all out at crateclub.us. Once again, that's crateclub.us. For you dog owners, check this out. You're going to love this. We've partnered with Kuna. Kuna has a team of trained canine handlers picking out a box for your dog each month of healthy treats and training aids. It's custom built for your dog's size and age as well. The products are U.S. sourced, all natural, and they not only promote a healthy diet, but they also promote being active with your dog. So whether we're talking a pit bull, chihuahua, doesn't matter what type of dog you have, this is just what you're looking for. You can see all of that at kuna.dog. That's kuna.dog. It's efficient for you. Your dog will appreciate it as well, of course, and that's spelled CUNA.DOG. Last, as a reminder for those listening, we have a limited time offer of a 50% discounted membership to the Spec Ops channel. That's our channel that offers the most exclusive shows, documentaries, and interviews covering the most exciting military content today. The Spec Ops channel premiere show Training Cell follows former Special Operations Forces as they participate in the most advanced training in the country. Everything from shooting schools, defensive driving, jungle and winter warfare, climbing, and much more. You can watch all of that content by subscribing to the Spec Ops channel. That's at specopschannel.com and take advantage of a limited time offer of 50% off your membership. Only $4.99 a month. The app is up. I have a last email really quick. I know Benny's got to get out of here. So I just want to read this from an anonymous guy very quick. Sent to softrep.radio@softrep.com. He wrote, I'm listening to the Dale Comstock interview. I had read his book. This guy is in my age, about mid-50s, and he's still out there working as an operative. That is incredible. Keep these broadcasts coming, and that's it. So, awesome. I mean, it really is true.
Dale's a beast. It's still going strong.
Yeah. No, it's incredible, and we're going to have him back soon. So with that, there we go. With that, I was going to say, be sure to check out Benedetta-Argentieri.com. PossibleFilm.com, which am I saying that correctly?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And at Ben Argentieri on Twitter, at Benny Arge on Instagram, BennyArge. If you are in the New York area and want to check out I Am the Revolution, that premieres at Sinopolis, Chelsea, New York City on Thursday, November 15th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are available at docnyc.net. We'll all be there. A lot of other people there. I'm excited for it. And, you know, if you guys like this episode, check it out. Take the drive out if you're in the, you know, tri-state area. Anything else before we wrap this up?
No, I think we're sorted.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming in, Benny.
Thank you.
It's been far too long, and everybody's excited for the film. So
thank you so much.
Great stuff.
Listening to Soft Rep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at Soft Rep Radio.